how to combine all fields of the Standard Model and gravity in a purely geometric Yang-Mills theory with a single connection. As soon as we get it up there, we'll have a schematic of the Standard Model. Ah, there it is. Screen. Good. Can you move the mouse pointer out of the way? Thank you. The Standard Model is kind of a mess. It consists of electroweak and strong gauge fields, the B, W, and G down here, interacting with a multiplicative Higgs scalars and Grassmann-valued spinner fields representing the three generations of fermions. And gravity is included in this picture with a bivector-valued one-form, the spin connection, and a Clifford vector-valued one-form, the frame, gravitational frame. Now, all these fields interact, which is kind of strange given that I just said that they are in different algebras. But in fact, all these algebras are interchangeable. And what I mean by this is that column matrices of spinners can be represented as elements of a Clifford algebra. And a Clifford algebra is a Lie algebra. And Lie algebra elements may be represented by matrices. So I'd like you to keep this in mind when I present the rest of my talk. That is, all these algebra elements are interchangeable. And if you think something is like another, that's because it is. And if you want to think of it any way you like, you can, and that will be right. So the next thing I show you is going to be this large matrix of one-forms and Grassmann numbers, which I've chosen to use a matrix representation because I think you'll find it the most familiar, having worked with many of these pieces over the course of your lives. So without further ado, here it is. This matrix is a connection. It's a BRST extended connection. What happens is this matrix has three blocks, H, G, and psi. The psi are the gauge ghosts, which appear via the standard mathematical application of the BRST gauge fixing technique, but used in a very non-standard way. That is, the fermions, the physical fermions, appear as the gauge ghosts, replacing part of this connection that is purely gauge. Okay, so we start out with a big connection, and this is a 16 by 16 matrix. Each one of these elements is a 2 by 2 block. And to compute, and we get a BRST extended connection, which is one form and Grassmann valued. And to compute its dynamics, we simply take the curvature of this connection. And this is meant to be a connection over a four-dimensional naked base manifold, if you like. This is just standard Yang-Mills theory, with a big Lie algebra represented by this matrix. Now, when you take the curvature, because of the block structure, the way this matrix is laid out, you get the curvature of the H, the curvature of the G, and over here you get the covariant Dirac operator, or part of it, on the block of spinners, with H acting as multiplication from the left and G acting as multiplication from the right. Now, what actually happens, if you can just think of this, you get the dynamics by squaring this big matrix. So you can do this in your head. That block of W's up there, you can see is in an SU2 representation. That's the weak field. When you square this matrix, that block multiplies itself. It multiplies that multiplicative Higgs and all the left chiral fermion multiplets. Similarly, when you square this matrix, this block of G mixes all the different colored quarks. With those eight gluons in there. And the last gauge field, the B of U1, lives in the diagonal part of H and G. And when you square this matrix, it multiplies the Higgs and it multiplies all the fermions, acting from the left and the right, as giving the correct hypercharge assignments for the Standard Model, which is kind of cute. And, there is one glaring deficiency of this matrix in that it only has one generation of fermions, as well as another deficiency, which is that something nice does happen. The Higgs there, when we multiply it through, it assigns Dirac masses to the left and right chiral fermions, but assigns the same mass to all of them. So no, I don't know how to get the masses yet. Now, the part of this matrix, as I said, this is composed of 2 by 2 blocks. So in these, the omega L and the omega R, as well as the EL and the ER, are the left and right chiral parts of the spin connection in the frame, which if you think you're familiar with those, you are. But just to confirm that for you, these come from the Weyl chiral representation of space-time Dirac matrices. So to represent four Dirac, four Clifford vectors for the Clifford CL13 algebra, you use a Kronecker product of polymatrices, and you get these 4x4 Dirac matrices that you can then multiply together to get six bivectors, six space-time bivectors. And you can use these various algebraic pieces to build the space-time frame and the spin connection, the frame being a Clifford vector-valued one form here, and the spin connection, a Clifford bivector-valued two form. And really, you can think of these as Lie algebra elements as well, or here shown the matrix representation. So these left and right chiral parts of the spin connection and frame are expressed explicitly in terms of polymatrices here, and that should be familiar for those of you familiar with the self-dual formulation of gravity, seeing that combination there. But anyway, this algebra, I've actually added these things together, which you can do in Clifford algebra. And this algebra of Clifford vectors and bivectors actually closes under the Lie bracket, which is just the commutator bracket. And this algebra is equivalent to SO14, which is the algebra of Clifford bivectors for a Clifford algebra of one higher dimension. So this equivalence is the key to the McDowell-Mansouri approach to gravity, revived recently by Lise Mullen and our Chemstar Dubsev and a few others to whom I owe a debt of gratitude, because if it weren't for them showing me how you can describe the degrees of freedom of gravity purely in terms of connection, I wouldn't have thought to expand this connection to, everything. So how do these blocks appear in that larger matrix I scared you with at first? And that is, we're not going to use CL14. We're going to use a slightly larger Clifford algebra, CL17, for which this is a matrix representation of the bivectors of this algebra. So if you like, this is just a matrix representation of SO17. If you haven't picked up on it yet, those little arrows designate one forms. And these are just the various pieces of the bosonic part of that big matrix, at least including the electroweak. The strong's going to come in a minute. Now, since we're doing CL18, the first four Clifford vectors in CL18 are just the space-time Clifford vectors, and the higher 5 through 8 Clifford vectors, I'll label with higher Greek indices here. But when you multiply these two to get bivectors, you get two sets of bivectors. You get a set of space-time bivectors, which you use to build the spin connection for gravity. The electroweak gauge fields go in the higher bivectors, using 4 out of 6 of them. And the really interesting thing happens in this combined frame Higgs bivector. Like I said, this is all one bivector, so it was kind of a neat trick to get there by starting with the gravitational frame, a space-time Clifford vector-valued one form, and introducing the Higgs as a higher Clifford vector-valued scalar. And to get this bivector valued one form, you multiply these two together in Clifford algebra, which is how you get Clifford bivectors. So it's an interesting sort of factoring of the algebra, if you like, but really the way to think of it is this Higgs frame object shares algebraic elements in this model, so that the Higgs and the frame, or Veerbaane, or whatever you wish to call it, share degrees of freedom through this multiplication. So since they share these degrees of freedom, this includes a overlap of the conformal degrees of freedom for this object, for the frame and the Higgs. So in order to get rid of this overlap, we have to choose to normalize one or the other of these things. So we'll go ahead and normalize the Higgs, giving it the Higgs vector length of m. And this reduces the degrees of freedom in our Higgs from 4 to 3. These are real degrees of freedom here. So That's kind of cute how that fits into a bivector, but now to show you how the dynamics of this thing works, we take the curvature of this connection, and just as this comes out as a bivector-valued two-form, we just plug this in using Clifford algebra, the fact that these different Clifford vectors anti-commute. And what we get is three parts, again, for the three different types of bivectors. The space-time bivectors give Riemann curvature, which is a Clifford space-time bivector value two-form, and this area term here, multiplied times that normalization for the Higgs. And the mixed bivectors give the gravitational torsion, as well as the covariant derivative of the Higgs, and the higher part just gives the electroweak curvature there. So these three parts then can be used to build an action for this part of the standard model. A nice way to do it is this modified BF action, remember, over a four-dimensional base. So we can do this as a topological theory, plus adding these other terms. I don't have a good explanation for where these other terms come from. This is purely my idea of how to get the standard model all together in a concise way so far. And if we vary B, these brackets here take the return the Clifford scalar part, or if you're doing this in a matrix representation, they return the trace. And this gives what should be at least a couple of fairly familiar action terms for the gauge fields. This one here is the action for Yang-Mills field. This one includes the covariant derivative, is quadratic in the covariant derivative of the Higgs, which is as it should be. It also includes a term quadratic in the torsion. And this piece here, interestingly enough, is equivalent to, well, up to a boundary term, equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is not obvious by looking at it because it looks like it's quadratic in this space-time curvature here. But I'll go ahead and go through that derivation in a page. This is the gravitational part of that action. Varying B, as I said you just plug the B back in, and this is the quadratic expression for the curvature. This gamma here is a Clifford pseudoscalar, which you get by multiplying the four space-time Clifford vectors together. If you like, it turns out in most representations to be a big matrix of I's, if you're using a matrix representation. But anyway, that you carry out, you plug in what the space-time curvature is, and you carry out, just expand these two parentheses, multiply them out, and you get three terms. The first term is a boundary term, the Chern-Simons boundary term, which we'll note as being interesting for being there at all, but toss it out. And the other two terms are the volume element and the curvature scalar. So this action is equivalent, up to a boundary term, to the Einstein-Hilbert action, provided we identify the cosmological constant as 3/4 times m squared. So this is kind of interesting. It says that the cosmological constant in this model turns out to be directly related to the normalization vacuum expectation value we've chosen for our Higgs, which is what gives all the particles their masses. This is the type of thing you expect to happen when you're trying to work with everything, but you have to hope that somehow you can make sense of the numbers in the end. Okay, so that's how the dynamics of it work. And now that I've taken you on a tour of it, you might be more willing to believe that, yes, this does represent, just in this matrix, all the interactions of the standard model as well as one generation of fermions. This part, this G, you can build these strong fields also using bivectors from SO17. But as I said, this has a glaring deficiency, and that is it only has one generation of fermions in it. And I put this together about a year ago and published it, well, put it on the archive, and spent the last year trying to figure out how to get two more generations of fermions out of this in any weird geometric way I could, trying all sorts of tricks, and nothing, didn't really get anywhere. So about 1 month ago, I finally decided to try the obvious thing, which is if this matrix is actually supposed to represent a big Lie algebra, then there perhaps should be a very large Lie group for which it is a matrix representation. I had put this together as just the nicest way I could think of to to write down all the interactions, but so I had no reason to really believe that would happen, especially since this structure wasn't familiar to me in terms of representing any group I knew of. But I counted up the number of Lie algebra generators, including three generations of fermions, and it comes out to 248. And I said, well, that's a damn big Lie group. I'll see what I can match it to. Yeah, I can probably see it right away, but you know, I think the first thing I tried was SO23. I'm a physicist, so I hadn't had much experience with the exceptional Lie groups. But it turns out that didn't work out so well, and E8 does have the Lie group E8. Out of all this list here of simple compact Lie groups, turns out to have the right number of degrees of freedom and is considered to be exceptionally beautiful, one of the most beautiful structures in mathematics, which is the type of thing you'd hope for if you're trying to build a theory describing everything. But so I went looking for the structure of E8, because just because the number of algebra generators is right doesn't mean that it has the structure I want. That seemed like a long shot, but sure enough, I dug up this week's finds by John Baez from about 10 years ago, in which he describes E8 as two blocks of SO8 acting on three blocks of 64 elements, which are related by this triality symmetry, and these SO8s multiply, act as left and right matrix multiplication on the three blocks, just like the H and the G. This is probably one of the best moments I've had in physics recently, just to come across this and have it fit so perfectly to what I had built, and it was just an amazing thing. If this turns out not to be the way nature works, it's probably her cruelest joke on me. But that's okay. It might just not work. But so immediately I had to get my hands on the Lie generators and the commutator brackets for E8, the structure constants for E8. And of course, as much as mathematicians like to talk about the beautiful structure of E8, you can't get one to write down the structure constants. So at least not in this form that includes triality. I looked a bit, and I was finally driven to consult the dark arts. I unearthed this dusty tome with a appendix scribed by he who shall not be named that included a bivector description of E8 that included its largest subgroup, compact subgroup, SO16. And there's a very interesting and kind of a beautiful and odd thing in here that I hadn't known about. And that is, right here in the structure constants for E8, appear a Clifford algebra matrix representation. These B and C pick out the matrix elements, and this alpha B, alpha beta here, is labeling a Clifford bivector for SO16. And this is hidden right here inside the structure constants of E8, as it turns out. So this says a very remarkable thing. This says that if E8 is at the root of the structure of the universe, then when you take the Lie algebra bracket of two of these elements, the algebra that gives is the algebra of Clifford bivector valued things acting as multiplication times column spinners. This S16 here is a column of 128 spinners, and this is just matrix multiplication going on here. You can see that in the structure constants, and this is another way of writing it. And that's really a beautiful thing, because that says that the very structure, if this is really fundamental, this is saying that spinners exist as a description for important in physics, because they're hidden right here in the structure of this Lie group, E8. I thought that was a cool thing, but these are not the generators, quite the generators we were looking for. These are SO16 generators, these gammas. And these Qs are S16 generators. We wanted SO8 and SO8 generators, so we just relabeled them. I shuffled these around, reassigning these to my HG, and after the 28H and 28G basis elements, there are 64 left over to put into a psi, and this 128 column spinners splits up into these two other 64 blocks of psi. And you get a representation for E8 this way. To get the structure constants, you just use the structure constants you have, since this is just a relabeling of generators. And you compute the new structure constants. And these are the ones that we're interested in over here. Because this says, sure enough, it's always kind of mystifying to me how they get this without actually grinding through the calculation. this H and this G act on these blocks of psi as multiplication from the left and right. This is one matrix multiplying another in this notation. And these things signify that they are not all the same matrices multiplying these things, but that they're multiplying in different representations. So this is damn near perfect. It means we can do what we're seeking out to do, which is put the whole standard model very tightly into a Lie algebra representation of E8. Well, it's not actually E8. It's not the compact form of E8. You have to use something called the real form of complex E8, which is a non-compact version of E8, because the Lorentz group has to be a subgroup of this, and the Lorentz group is non-compact. So I guess you could call it E17. Mathematicians just call it another version of E8. But it's easy enough to build, because remember the structure constants are built from Clifford algebra representation, so we can just use the Clifford algebra representation for CL17 and get the structure constants for this non-compact version of E8. So this is looking really good, and it's what I said I was going to do, which is put the entire standard model in a single connection, represented here as a different segments of matrices of Grassmann numbers in one forms. So what's wrong with it? Why didn't I publish this immediately? And that is because I'm not quite done with it. Like I said, I only found this a month ago, and there is still this problem that the H and the G multiply one of these blocks of one generation in the correct way, but it multiplies the other two with a different representation, which means there's got to be some mixing and perhaps a different placement of these subgroups I've chosen, the subgroups of the standard model gauge fields into E8, that'll give the right charge assignments to these fermions. So this is what I'm going to play with, and like I said, it may just not work, but if it does work, it's such a tight fit that I think it'll either succeed spectacularly or just fail utterly. So there's not a lot of wiggle room here. So that's what I'm going to be spending my time on for the coming months, is trying to get the right phases of how to fit this all together in E8 such a way that the eigenvalues come out right for the charge assignments, and hopefully get the CKM PMNS mass mixing matrix out of it so I can call it something else. And that's what I'm shooting for. Like I said, it'll either be spectacularly successful or utterly fail. All right, so I did what I said I was going to do. Remember, the fermions here entered in a very non-standard way as the ghosts of the gauge, purely gauge part of this connection. This is just a standard application of the BRST gauge fixing technique, but done in a odd way. And what does it mean for what does it mean for you, loop quantum gravity community? And I already listed the things that I'm not clear on, but what it really means for you is that, well, beyond the fact that modified BF gravity, the McDowell-Mansuri approach, as it's being used now in loop quantum gravity, is a very integral part of this model, and if you consider this model to have any significance, then that approach is quite favored. And also that there's this interesting question of how the frame Higgs really entered as a combined object. But really, I just wanted to say that the reason I'm here talking with you is that the people in this room are adept at methods for quantizing connections in a background-independent way, and this is a way of generalizing whatever successful approaches are found in quantum gravity for a connection to a more than slightly larger Lie group, but that's all it is. It's qualitatively the same, and the qualitative problems of how to go from, say, quantizing a compact Lie group to quantizing a non-compact one, the qualitative problems are identical. It's a small matter of scale. So you extend some successful loop quantum gravity method to this very large connection, and I think at least what I'm shooting for, if this all works out, is that this will be a very successful theory of, well, Toto. And that's about all I have to say. I should probably take some questions. There is one more thing I'll say, and that is probably as a result of having to go through a derivation of a theory of everything in 20 minutes, I've had to rush through some of these calculations and some of the detail, but what I've been showing you here is actually the pages of a wiki. So if you go online to deferentialgeometry.com, all these links, these slides I've been showing you are PDF printouts of pages from this wiki, and all these blue things here are links that link up to notes describing all these things in more detail and how all the mathematical manipulations work out. And also one more thing, if anyone would like to come talk to me in person while they have the chance, I will be hanging out in the Hotel Cathedral lobby at 8 p.m. tonight. Bring a laptop if you can, and we'll play a bit. So, yeah, that's about all I have to say, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, so this is kind of thing. This is, if it's right, it's very important, it's very beautiful. But you might go back a little bit slowly with some of the basics.
Absolutely. Which part?
So let's start from the gravity side. The gravity side, you have an algorithm that you can fit in signature, so this would be inside.
With the what? Okay, fine. The reason.
So there's the SO5 representation of gravity via the action.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. And you bump that up to an SO8 for some reason.
Yes, so you can fit.
How do you bump that up to an SO8 and an SO5?
You just choose to work in a larger Lie algebra.
Okay. So that's just because you're looking for a beautiful structure.
That's right. So remember, I've told you half. I've kind of presented it in an odd way, which is I've been working incrementally. Building up, trying to shape the standard model in the most efficient way I could. And I got this weird matrix-looking thing. And then I went looking, and sure enough, it matched E8. So if I tell this story from the top down, right, if this thing actually works, right, if this really works well, the way I'll describe it is the universe can be described by a E8 gauge theory, a principal bundle, a principal E8 bundle, classically. It's up to you guys to quantize it. Now, the action, there will be some action for this theory. Great. Yes. Yes. Absolutely correct. Yes. Yes. There are two SO8s. Let me go back to the second slide. Oh, I went forward instead of backwards. Yes. So, two SO8s. H is in the first SO8, which here is an SO17. G is in the second SO8. Okay? So the H is here. This is the block of H's. This block here. This is the block of G's, which also has a piece of B down the diagonal here, which commutes with all the G's. And these are the 8 gluons. You know, I had to shorten it in order to fit it on the screen, but, you know, there are 8 gluons in there.
Okay, now, these things are connections valued in which happened there, but there's going to become the 8. So why are the off-diagonal things still in us? Why aren't they,
yes. So you start out with an E8 principal bundle with some action, with some terms in there that break the symmetry of E8. But you have that part of the action, the psi part, or that part of the connection, the psi part of the psi block of algebra elements that start out as a one form, as an algebra valued one form, are purely gauged. They can be gauged away. There's a gauge transformation that can take all of them to zero. Okay? Now, what you do is, I have an extra slide for this. And that is, you do the BRST gauge fixing technique. So, you introduce these BRST ghosts, here I start out calling them C, an anti-ghost B, and you get this nice BRST global BRST gauge transformation, you get a new effective Lagrangian, which this Lagrange multiplier that sets this block. This is what starts out as the psi in what I'm saying. That gets set to zero by this Lagrange multiplier, and you have this extra term, the ghost potential, that gives this term in the effective Lagrangian. But it turns out that there's this neat thing you can do where you can get the same dynamics by including these BRST ghosts as part of a hybrid connection, which is now a connection that's one-form valued and Grassmann valued. If you don't like this trick, you could just do the standard BRST and not do that extra trick. But this is a pretty standard and well-known trick, because then you can just compute the curvature, including the curvature of these C things, and you get that this here ends up acting on the size and gives you the right Dirac term.
Okay, please
take
this.
No, please. I really like your questions. I'd like you to ask more. I don't think anyone would fight you for that microphone. Please ask another.
Okay, so BRST ghosts become infermions.
Correct. It's an unusual thing. Now,
is that your invention?
This is completely my invention. I made it up. I published it in a paper. Well, once again, I put it on the archive. I only put out a paper once every 2 years. I only write when I think I've found something neat, since I don't have any academic pressure. I put this out, and it turns out that this mathematics of BRST theory, you start out with parts of your connection that vary with a gauge transformation. And you do BRST gauge fixing, and that introduces these other fields. When you get rid of the gauge part of the connection, you replace it with these BRST ghosts that are Grassmann valued fields. But they still live in the same Lie algebra that they're replacing. Okay, so this is very standard. And if you start with E8, you start out with this purely a principal E8 bundle. You start out with these Lie algebra elements. And it turns out that part of this Lie algebra, because of the structure of E8, acts like these columns of spinners. Okay, they're spinners in here. They transform the correctly under the Lorentz group. They're, algebraically, they're spinners. Now, using the BRST technique, these one-forms in the action are replaced with their Grassmann-valued things. Okay, that's part of the BRST technique, is these ghosts are Grassmann numbers. So you end up with columns of Grassmann numbers. So this idea I had that's totally crazy is basically it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck. I'm going to call it a duck. So I said, well, maybe the fermions, the physical fermions, are really gauge ghosts. This is non-standard. It's a standard mathematical technique, absolutely essential to quantum field theory, but it's used in a very non-standard way. Now, there is a rule you have to get rid of in quantum field theory if this is going to be true. The rule is that when you do propagators with ghosts, ghosts are not supposed to be in external lines for computing. Yeah. I think that rule is completely superfluous. There's no mathematical reason for that rule to exist. It's kind of dangling there, and if you cut it out, it doesn't hurt anything else in quantum field theory. So that's what you have to do for this to be viable. But that's it. All the other structure is there. The algebraic structure of fermions is sitting there in that Lie group. It's a really beautiful thing. I sure hope it's true. It would be a shame if it wasn't, but I'm starting to sound like string theorist now. So I always have to watch that. You're asking excellent questions. I'd hate to stop you. Well, John Baez is probably a better person to ask for that. This triality symmetry of E8 is intimately related to the octonions, yes. But, I do a lot of mathematics and I like it, and I'm going to spend the next year studying it much more depth. I'm not expert at the octonions yet. And really, I just see this as one of, this is all the Lie groups that are classified. It's really a remarkable thing how this comes out. And it is all these exceptional groups. These are the ones we're used to using in physics, the classical groups that we're all familiar with. These exceptional groups, are really beautiful geometric structures. So when you describe a Lie group as a manifold, it has these higher Lie groups like E8 is a 248 dimensional manifold. Okay? Now, that's all that's going on in this theory. In this theory, I keep going through my talk and then just showing you slides that you haven't seen before, but this is very fun. And that is, so if you take G here to be E8, it's really just a big manifold that has vector fields on it, that are killing vector fields. And these killing vector fields are, when you put them in the Lie derivative, they give the structure constants. And these are the left invariant vector fields on a group manifold. And these are totally equivalent. So when I said that all these algebraic elements were interrelated, in fact, I just made all that algebra go away by replacing them with vector fields on one manifold. So this is what I mean by when I say that this theory is purely geometric. It's a Yang-Mills theory. It includes only the vector field flow on a big geometric manifold, and a principal bundle is built by explaining how this large manifold twists over some base manifold. And in this theory, the really remarkable thing in this theory is all you have in the theory is a big manifold and diffeomorphisms of that manifold, period, for a principal bundle. That's it. You're not putting in any Minkowski signature, nothing. All you have is the structure of this one manifold. Everything comes out of that. You get the killing form, which gives you, which relates to the frame and gives you a metric on a group space. And everything in the algebra, the structure of spinners, the structure of Clifford algebra representations, everything is packed in here just in the vector fields of this one manifold. It's in the diffeomorphisms of this one big, beautiful manifold. This is why I love general relativity, is because it's geometric. And this is, in a sense, more geometric than GR. And it's why mathematicians like theory of fiber bundles so much. But yeah, I hope you'll come talk to me at 8 p.m. I'd hate to be lonely in there. Any more questions, if you'll allow the time? You might want to allow people to get up and go, but I don't think there's another session in here after this one.
Yeah.
Ah. Yes. To do what?
Parameter counting?
Yep. There are, in each one of these guys, there are four real degrees of freedom. And these are 4x4 matrices. So we have left and right chiral blocks of fermions. So it's the way you first deal with them. The first time you see these are Weyl fermions. Okay, so remember I used the Weyl representation. And this spreads throughout the whole thing. We have the neutrinos here for the electron, neutrinos for the muon, neutrinos for the tau. Are you happy with that, John?